Good morning, everyone. Welcome back to Law Matters. My name is Maya Thompson, and I am one of the interns on the show. My fellow intern, Nathan Chabin, and I will be conducting the interview today with our teachers, Mr. Paul Karlowitz and Dr. John Hosmer. Mr. Karlowitz, how are you this morning?
Good morning. I'm doing just fine. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, of course. So a few weeks ago, we had the chair of the FEC, James Traynor, on, and for the 2020 election and the alleged fraud, his suggestion to solve the alleged fraud was that state legislature could change legislation and could send in their own electors. And as the Electoral College vote nears, is this a viable solution for solving alleged fraud?
Well, it would depend upon the state and what the current state law was in effect on election day. So with the Electoral College, essentially the Constitution leaves it up to the states to determine how to choose their electors. And most of the states have a winner-take-all system. Whichever candidate gets the most popular votes in the state gets the entire slate of electors appointed by his political party. Some states in more recent years have said by law, they have passed a law saying that the electors must vote for the candidate that they are slated to vote for. So, for example, after the 2016 election, because there were a number of protests up in Phoenix when the electors were sent to vote for Donald Trump, the Republican-controlled legislature passed a law saying that in the next election, 2020, the Arizona electors must vote for the candidate that they claimed to support when the popular vote selected them. And so in Arizona, for example, that's not a viable option, because if the state legislature were to try to change the law now, that would be a retroactive or an ex post facto effect, and that would be unconstitutional. So it would depend upon the state that the president and his supporters are looking at as to whether the electors are free agents or whether they are by law compelled to vote for the candidate that they were selected to vote for.
Right. And so have all the states sent in their list of electors by now?
Yes. And okay. The Electoral College is due to vote in each of the respective state capitals on Monday. So the real presidential election actually is taking place on Monday.
So we should know by Monday who the president-elect is?
Yes, officially by the Electoral College, by the end of Monday, we should know exactly what the electoral vote is, and it probably is not going to be too far off of what the predictions are based upon the results of the popular vote in each state.
Right. I'm getting a message. Dr. Hosmer, are you on now?
I am. Thank you very much.
All right. Welcome to the show. And so another issue is, you know, this brings up problems with the Electoral College. And, you know, there have been many challenges to it because presidents can win elections without winning the popular vote. What are your opinions on the Electoral College? Should it be abolished? Should it be changed? Yes, Mr. Karlowitz.
Well, again, the idea of abolishing the Electoral College is something of a pipe dream, because it would take a constitutional amendment.
Okay.
And there are enough states that are overrepresented in the Electoral College. The smaller, less populated states are overrepresented. So their representatives and senators are certainly not going to support any kind of an amendment proposal coming through Congress. And it takes a 3/4 vote of the state legislatures to ratify an amendment. And there are enough states to block an amendment to get rid of the Electoral College at this time because of this. And so we're not going to get rid of the Electoral College in reality. So it's up to the states to then pass laws to determine how they select their electors. And so, for example, Maine and Nebraska select their electors by congressional district instead of winner-take-all statewide, where the winner of the popular vote gets all the electors. It goes congressional district by congressional district. That's considered to be a little bit more reflective of the popular vote in the state. Some states like Arizona have passed laws saying the electors must vote for the candidate that they claim to vote for when they were selected. And so that takes away the idea of having a faithless elector casting a vote for whomever they would like to select. some states have considered, but I'm not aware of any state have passing this law yet, but have considered saying we will base our electoral vote on the national popular vote. So whomever wins the national popular vote, our state's electors are going to vote for that person. I'm not aware of any state that has actually passed that law, but I know that it's been considered in some of the states.
Do you know which states have considered that?
No, I do not at
all
this
right.
point.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Hosmer, historically, what is your view on the Electoral College? Has it been successful? Is it representative of the American people?
Most of the time, the Electoral College has been almost anonymous. The vote has gone with, the popular vote has gone with the Electoral College. The only time the issue comes up, of course, is when there is a dispute, 2000, and then, of course, in 2016. But predominantly, the Electoral College has worked fairly well, and it's worked the way the Founding Fathers wanted it to back in 1788. So more than likely, Mr. Carlowitz is right on the money. It won't change minority states, particularly, you know, places like Wyoming and the Dakotas will simply object. And there is an argument that says you have to protect the minority in American politics. So I'm guessing it will be extremely difficult to change the Electoral College anytime in the future. No, I don't think you can change it. It would be, Mr. Carlowitz is right. You'll have to have a constitutional amendment, and then you'll get the East Coast and the West Coast that would dominate because of their population concentration, and the result is that the Midwest would feel abandoned, and that and so as a result, they will never support a constitutional transformation. And what the argument is going to be, the Electoral College works fairly well, so you know, let's not change it.
Right. Okay. Moving on from the sort of Electoral College talk and to more recent events, we've had a lot of issues with the transition of power and President Trump refusing to concede the election. This question is for you, Dr. Hosmer. Have there been other times in history when a president has refused to transition power?
No, there's never been where a president has simply said, I'm not going to help. There have been times where you've had, you know, disputes, but they were, you know, in the 19th century. The election of 24 was disputed between Jackson and John Quincy Adams. That was a contentious election that led to 4 years of a really sad presidency for John Quincy Adams. And then, of course, the big one, the one that set the tone, was in right after the Civil War, 1876. And there you had a compromise, ostensibly, between the North and the South over who should be the president. And it was it's the closest election in the Electoral College in American history, where Rutherford B. Hayes finally won by one electoral vote. So, you know, you find, but no one ever said, "Okay, I'm not leaving the office." Once it was decided. And Congress made the decision, the loser, in every single case, was gracious enough, with maybe the exception of John Adams in 1800. He did not attend Thomas Jefferson's inauguration in a pit of the sort of unhappiness. And so as a result, he stayed in Massachusetts.
Right. And I think President Trump is... currently, he hasn't said if he will attend Joe Biden's inauguration, but it sounds like historically, when there are contested elections, it doesn't really bode well for the following president's term. Do you think Joe Biden will be affected in the same way?
Biden's in a different spot, and it's going to be really interesting to see in 20, 30 years how historians actually view this. But the interesting thing about the Biden election to me was how the extremes on the Democratic Party came together with the moderates. And I thought it was interesting. You see Susan Collins in Maine, for example, who's a pretty moderate Republican, if there is such a thing. And she won handily. And Joe Biden won with a large number of in the plurality of the popular vote. I think the country was looking for some type of moderation. And if I were Joe Biden right now, I'd be having martinis with Mitch McConnell, because he's got to find a way to negotiate if the Senate stays in Republican hands. And Biden's better than Obama was. Obama had this feeling that things would work out, but Biden's a politician, and he spent a lot of time hobnobbing. And, you know, one of his best friends was John McCain. And the two of them worked together fairly well. I have a feeling Biden's going to try to do that and turn this division. But he doesn't have to deal with a lot of people. He just has to deal with Mitch McConnell. And I won't be a bit surprised if he's not on the phone with McConnell right now. And they're talking about the things they can get done. And there may not be as many as he wants, but there will be some. And it will be a mutual benefit for both guys. We'll see what happens. And I think that has to do with Trump fatigue, that there are people who have this tiredness, and they just want to see some kind of moderation. And I do, you sense that from, you know, when Maine elected Collins and the country elected Biden, they're looking for some kind of quiet and let's just pursue, especially if you can get that vaccine and solve the pandemic. That will be his biggest challenge in the future.
Right. Well, you mentioned Mitch McConnell, but there is a possibility that he will no longer be the speaker of, or the leader of the Senate, right? And that's in the case if both of the senators in Georgia win the runoff election, both of the Democratic senators in Georgia win the election. Do you think there's a legitimate chance that Mitch McConnell will lose that position?
I think that's a really good question. And I'll tell you who the people are desperate to try and figure that out are pollsters. Because where Donald Trump lost the election in 2020, the second biggest losers were pollsters. I mean, God, they came out with all these predictions, and very few of them turned out to be correct. You can make a mistake in 2016 and say, well, Hillary's going to win. But to make the same mistake again in 20, that just, I mean, what are we using? You know, slide rules and abacus, and that is just crazy. So they will spend a great deal of time trying to figure out what went wrong, and you know they're going to test it out in Georgia. So you'll get, you're going to get these pollsters who are down there working really hard to figure out if the Dems can win in Georgia. And I mean, Georgia, get serious. I mean, this is Gone with the Wind. This is Scarlett O'Hara. You couldn't get any more of a red state that suddenly turned purple. I think that's up in the air. I would be very surprised if both Senate seats went for the Democrats, and then Harris, as the vice president, would cast the deciding vote. But I mean, I'd be hard pressed to see something would be, you know, the bottom wheels on top. It will be an interesting thing to see what happens in January, and it's going to be a lot bigger than people think. It's going to be a massive transformation in the United States government.
Right. I mean, so you're saying don't watch the polls. You know, we can't trust the polls.
I think the pollsters are going to try really hard to figure out what exactly happened. And, I mean, you can make a mistake once, but you make it twice and people then stop listening to you. And so, you know, eventually they'll come up with some kind of a formula. And you just know they're going to test it out in Georgia and see if they're right for the 2022 election. I wouldn't put a lot of store in the polls right now, but you never know how things are going to go. I mean, Georgia really is a unique place for the American South, for a state that was as red as it was. And, of course, it has to do with the influx of Northerners into what they call the New South, you know, in places like Atlanta. And but is there enough, and can the Democrats generate enough energy and support? Maybe. It'll be interesting.
Right. So say they do, both senators win. What would that mean for the Biden administration?
Well, the first thing it's going to mean, in my mind, and it'll be interesting to see what Mr. Karlovitz thinks, the first thing it's going to empower, amazingly enough, the far extremes of the Democrat Party. If the Dems control the Senate, then what's going to happen is Ocasio-Cortez will want more say because they will be able to pass more legislation, her Green New Deal, for example. That's going to put pressure on Biden, who's a moderate.
Right.
And so as a result, if to some extent Biden can always say, well, I can't do anything about it if the Republicans control the Senate. The whole thing, this is just a fascinating series of events, and you'll have to see how it pans out. But if he does, first thing, of course, is the virus. The second thing is going to be that he'll pick things, sort of low-hanging fruit, and that would be infrastructure. Let's build better roads. Let's have better, airports. If you go to an airport in America, they have a tendency not to be as sharp and as new as airports, say, in Asia or in Europe. And so there will be an infrastructure push. I think that if the Democrats win, there will also be more stimulus spending. Republicans will crumble.
Right. Yeah, okay. So, Mr. Karlovitz, what do you think about that? What would that mean for the Biden administration?
You're talking about the elections in Georgia?
Yeah, the runoff elections.
Yeah, well, obviously, if one is a Democrat, you want to see that both the Democrats win. If one is a Republican, you want to see the Republicans win. And at this point, it seems like a toss-up in both of the races. However, let's just suppose the two Democrats win and the vice president casts the deciding vote, so it's 51-50. Let's just take that as a suppose.
Okay.
Senate rules are much different than House rules, and the Senate rules say that one senator can ask for a hold on a bill, and unless the majority leader can come up with 60 votes to block that hold, that vote doesn't come up and before the Senate. And so most Americans don't understand that the Senate rules require a supermajority in order for bills to come to a vote. If the majority leader ignores the senator's hold, then that's pretty much of a statement by them to say that we're going to filibuster this. And currently, Senate rules say that it takes 60 senators to break the filibuster. So even if the Republicans lose both of the election, they have Senate rules on their side to be able to block what they would consider to be the most obnoxious laws that could be coming through, or bills that would be coming through from the House through the hold in the filibuster. And so it would not be a total disaster from a Republican perspective if they lost both seats. Now, obviously, if the Republicans win one of the two or both of the seats, then they're the majority and they control the Senate. And would be able to stop whatever they would see as most obnoxious coming from, or most objectionable coming from the House of Representatives.
So, moving on kind of from that, America has had a political de-alignment, right, since 1968, since the election of 1968. So if both senators win in Georgia, does that mean we no longer have divided government?
Are we talking about both the Democratic candidates?
Yes, both
winning?
Democratic candidates.
Well, you wouldn't have divided government per se, because technically the Democrats would control both houses of Congress, and at the same time they would control the presidency. But just like President Obama faced in his first couple of years as president, when the Democrats had a large majority in the Senate, they had 59 senators. because he was one vote short of the 60, the Republicans were able to put holds and threaten filibusters to block health care reform. And so that magic number in the Senate still is 60. And again, that's something that many Americans don't understand, that the Senate has these particular rules, because the belief was is that every senator has certain privileges because they represent a sovereign state. And therefore, it goes back to the idea that the United States government is ultimately based upon the 50 states, and the 50 states then delegate powers to the federal government.
So even if both the Democrats win in Georgia, it doesn't necessarily mean that Biden will just get all of his legislation through. He'll like be unchecked.
Oh no, no. It wouldn't be something that the Republicans would like to see, obviously, but they would still have some bullets left in their gun to be able to create a political force in the Senate to stop what they would consider to be the most objectionable legislation.
And so having, like, per se, a full, like, almost like Democratic government made of Democrats, would that be representative of America? You know, in this election, are we moving towards having more unity in politics, or are we still very de-aligned?
Well, I think that you probably were more de-aligned than ever before, that I think there are a number of Americans that have in the last 4 years, maybe more, have turned away from the political fray because of the hyperbole that has existed. So it'll be interesting to see how President-elect Biden handles it once he takes office.
So, Dr. Hosmer, I have a question for you, and it has to do with, you know, how will people in textbooks look at this election in 40 years?
Oh, gosh, if I could answer that, I would also be able to predict the lottery, which 40 years. I remember when Richard Nixon resigned in 74, they interviewed a whole series of historians, and the historians almost universally said, oh, he's going to go down as one of the worst presidents in history. And I kept thinking, why are you making that prediction at this point? You can't possibly know what's going to happen with Nixon's reputation in 40 years. And Maya, that's because, to be pedantic for just a second, if you think about it for a moment, history is the past absolutely happened. And yet the past is not recreatable. So consequently, to talk about things that happened yesterday or 100 years ago, a person has to deal with interpretation. All history is by definition an interpretation. And what historians do is they go into the past and they look at documents and videos and they look at newspaper articles and letters. And then they construct what they thought happened 100,000 years ago. Well, the problem is that to do that, most historians tend to look at how things are going in their life at the time. And 40 years from now, it will be a really difficult thing to be able to say. There are people who will defend Donald Trump. There's an article in the New York Times recently that argued, interestingly, that he is certainly one of the top 10 presidents in American history. Will most historians agree with that 40 years from now? I think it'll depend a lot on how they look out their window and they go, how did it turn out like this? And in 40 years, when you have children and grandchildren, they'll look out the window and they'll go, you know, Grandma, how did it turn out like this? And they'll go back and look and say, well, it all started with Donald Trump. Is that good or bad? So it's an extremely difficult, and historians are foolish to try and have any kind of prognostication about the future. It will be an interpretation, and there will be historians that will write Trump did a good job, and there will be others that say, you know, he's worse than Millard Fillmore, and or James Buchanan, the man who oversaw the secession of the South.
Okay, wow. And Mr. Karlowitz, how do you think this election will affect American politics for the next few years?
Well, again, it's one of those things where you say, all right, what is President-elect Biden going to do? How is he going to proceed? Can he, in some ways, at the same time, make a deal with Mitch McConnell? And he's going to have to make a deal with McConnell, regardless of who wins those Senate seats in Georgia, because of the Senate rules.
Right.
Okay, now, if he makes a deal with McConnell and moves to the center, is the Democrats that exist on the far left, are they going to stay with Biden? Or are they going to then revolt? And there's been some signs of saying that maybe that might be Biden's biggest problem, is the Democrats on the left, because both he and former President Obama have said publicly, be careful, you people, about talking about defunding the police and all of this. That's counterproductive. And is there going to be a division within the Democratic Party between the moderates led by Biden and supported by former President Obama and those on the left that want to see reform and are becoming more and more impatient and saying some things that actually might be counterproductive to getting what actually in the long term they really want?
Right. And so was there anyone, you know, we didn't have a national convention this year, it was online, but is there anyone who looks good for the presidential nomination in 2024?
For the Democrats?
Yeah, if Biden doesn't run again.
Yeah, well, it's hard to say that at this point. You have to figure that Vice President Harris would be somebody that would be a force to be contended with, because why would Biden pick her to be vice president if there wasn't some belief that she had a constituency within the Democratic Party and felt that she was electable on a national scale with independents and maybe some moderate Republicans? So you would have to figure that she would be one of a number of candidates. Beyond that, to be honest with you, I don't know who would be there, but I'm sure that there will be if Biden says, I'm not running. There will be a dozen people that will be throwing their hats in the ring. Generally, you look to, okay, who are the Democratic governors and who are some of the leading Democratic senators, because being a governor of a state and a senator tend to be the blasting off points into the presidency.
Okay, well, we're going to take a quick commercial break. And when we return, my co-host Nathan Chabon will take over with some more questions for our guests, Dr. Hosmer and Mr. Karlowitz. Please stay with us.
This is Nathan Chabon, producer for Law Matters. I have a goal to reach, and I need your help. I want to put the DEA out of business. That's right, the Drug Enforcement Agency. If you have an addiction problem or know someone who does, please reach out to lawmatters1030.org and click the DEA tab for more information. Reaching out is the first step. We have the resources if you have the will. You can beat this demon and help me put the Drug Enforcement Agency out of business.
To report suspected human trafficking, please call the National Human Trafficking Resource Center at 1-888-373-7888 or text HELP or INFO to 233-733. To learn more about Homeland Security investigations and our efforts to combat human trafficking, please visit our website at www.ice.gov or check out the DHS Blue Campaign at www.dhs.gov/bluecampaign. For more information on the Southern Arizona Anti-Trafficking Unified Response Network, please visit us at www.saturn.org or find us on Facebook.
Daylight is fading and the temperature is dropping. You are not only cold, hungry, and lost in a densely wooded area, you're injured. Time is of the essence. SARCI is a highly trained team of dedicated volunteers who work closely with Pima County Search and Rescue to help people in critical situations just like this. To join an exclusive team of heroes, go to SARCI.org. That's SARCI.org. We need your knowledge, experience, and of course, your generous spirit.
Hi, I'm Maya Thompson, producer for the Law Matters live show that airs Saturday mornings at 8, when our listeners ask questions of the people who have answers. On our next show, we'll meet our newly elected Santa Cruz County Sheriff David Hathaway and talk with Sheriffs Daniels and Napier about future plans. This show depends on your support. Please go to lawmatters1030.org to contribute. If you missed us live, check out Law Matters on iTunes, Google Play, and of course, lawmatters1030.org website. Now get your questions ready and join our conversation at 790-2040.
Welcome back to Law Matters. We are here with Dr. John Hosmer and Mr. Paul Karlowitz. My name is Nathan Chapin. I am also an intern from University High School, and I will be taking over the moderating from here on out. And also, hi to my third grade teacher, Ms. Stockfleet. I know you're listening. All right, let's dive back into it. So this last election, we saw something a little unique with some of the states and how they voted. So are we seeing a political realignment of different states' orientations in terms of political parties that they're voting for? So, for example, is Arizona becoming more of a blue state? Is Florida becoming more of a red state? Texas maybe even purple? What are we seeing? What do you think, Mr. Karlowitz?
Well, I don't know if you can make a judgment based upon this election alone. It'll be interesting to see what happens in the next election if Arizona remains Democratic. Then you might say, well, in Arizona there is a realignment occurring. If Georgia remains Democratic in 24, then you might say, well, yes, there might be a realignment of sorts happening. Right now, I don't think that there is a realignment particularly happening. I think it's more of a de-alignment where more and more voters still are registering as independents, and they decide the election. And I think that in Arizona, in this election, the analysis would be, why did Arizona go Democratic? I think President Trump, through his words and his actions over the last 4 years, offended enough Republicans in Arizona by carrying on essentially a feud with John McCain. And even after Senator McCain died, he continued with, you know, to lambaste him, that I think there was enough Republicans that voted the Republican ticket all the way up to the top and then followed Cindy McCain's advice and voted for Biden. I think enough independents in Maricopa County did the same thing, because generally Maricopa, that's been a Republican stronghold, and it was Democratic this year, and that's why Arizona went down Democratic. Now, will that same thing happen in 4 years? Well, who knows? Maybe if the Democrats can continue to mobilize Hispanic voters, and you have a lot of people still coming into Arizona from other places, and they bring their politics with them. And so if you have people from blue states that are migrating to Arizona for various reasons, and they continue with their Democratic affiliation, that's a possibility Arizona could stay Democratic. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in 24. As for Georgia and some of the southern states, it's the same thing. Only can the Democrats continue to mobilize African-American voters, because they're a dependable Democratic constituency, and do you have more people from blue states migrating to those states like Georgia that then bring their politics with them? And so I think the 2024 election might answer that question better than I can right now.
And the same question to you, Dr. Hosmer. Do you think there's a political realignment?
I agree with Paul on this. I think it's going to be too soon to tell. One of the things, though, that is very clear from the last several elections is that if there is an alignment, the great worry of and if you looked at any of the political ads in by Republicans was that Democrats are essentially becoming socialist. And nobody quite knows what socialism means, but the fact of the matter is that if you look at the two coasts, the East and the West, they're clearly the blue states. And the reason is because they're more metropolitan. When you put a lot of people in metropolitan areas, they want more government action. They want police, they want hospitals, they want roads. And so consequently, they want government to be involved. And a lot of people call that turning socialistic. As America becomes more urban and less rural, I think that trend will certainly continue. And that means there will be more blue. And I think that's one reason that Atlanta, for example, went so heavily Democratic in this last election. But I agree with Paul. Places like Maricopa, still a hotbed of the Republican Party.
Yeah. So, Mr. Karlowitz, now, what do you think will be the goals of the Biden administration in both the long and short term? I know that the pandemic has overshadowed almost every other issue, but what do you think will be the goals of the Biden administration in terms of healthcare, education, foreign policy, and healthcare, that type of stuff?
Well, I think President Biden will try to do first is obviously remedy the pandemic. And it appears that there is light at the end of the tunnel on this issue, but that's going to be the issue first and foremost. That's going to be the trigger to anything else that he can accomplish. He has made some statements about tackling the issue of immigration and how do we have naturalization reform on that, but has not been terribly clear on how we'll go about it, obviously in maybe a more humane manner than has been happening in the past. He has been talking about reforming Medicare to some degree, that is part of what he's called Biden care, that he would advocate lowering the age to age 60 to be eligible for Medicare. He has talked about that. Obviously, he has talked about the issue of environmentalism, global warming, or climate change, depending upon how you want to name those issues. But these are enormous, enormous issues. And in many ways, it is going to be an interesting look at how he is going to be able to manage dealing with the Republicans in the Senate, especially concerning the Senate rules, regardless of what happens in Georgia in the elections, and maintaining the left wing of the Democratic Party in his grasp as well. And that's going to be the interesting political maneuver that he's going to have to make, is how can he satisfy the left wing of the Democratic Party and the moderates in both the Republican and Democratic parties to get things done. Is he going to be a skillful enough politician to be able to accomplish that essentially high wire aerial act? And that remains to be seen. I mean, that if he's able to do that, he will go down as one of the better presidents that we have had in our history. Will he be able to do it? That's a big question.
Absolutely. So Biden often speaks about uniting the country. How do you think that he will go about this? And do you think this is even possible? Dr. Hosmer, you kind of touched upon this a little bit earlier, so I'm going to let you expand upon that.
Well, I think Mr. Krogowitz has hit on it. Biden is a politician, and he's probably the best politician that we've had in a long time. At least that's what his record has indicated. Yeah, 30 years in the Senate, and he understands the process. My guess is that he's going to work really hard to try and negotiate with, first Mitch McConnell. And like I said, I wouldn't be a bit surprised if they're not, tipping glasses as we speak, sitting having breakfast and talking about various things. Okay, Mitch, what is it that you want? What can you give me? And there will be that back and forth. Obama was not very good at that. For all of his positive qualities, Obama never was able to accomplish the sort of things. And he let the Republican Party pretty much obstruct his major goals. One of the things I think that's interesting, however, let me go back historically. In 1862, Lincoln was playing with the idea of emancipating slaves, and it caused a firestorm in American politics. And very quickly, Lincoln began to back away. Well, I really wasn't going to free the slave. And what happened is he angered his left wing, the left wing of the Republican Party. And Lincoln turned to his Secretary of State and said, who are they going to vote for? I mean, they can be as angry as they want, but they're not going to vote for the other side. And so the Gang of Four, Cortez and her cronies, who are they going to vote for? They've got to tie themselves to Biden, and they'll ask for things. And my guess is that using Vice President Harris, Biden will be able to negotiate in a more fluent way than many people think. I will be surprised if the left wing of the Democratic Party becomes as obstreperous as the Tea Party did for the Republicans back in 2004. So I'm a little more hopeful that politics will play out. You'll still have a divide, but if there's anybody, it seems to me Biden can probably do it. He's not a very good politician. I mean, he wasn't the choice. Nobody much wanted him. Look at Iowa. I mean, what, he came in fifth, and in New Hampshire he got killed and even left. He's not a good politician, but being a politician in the 21st century, does that mean you won't be a good president? I don't know. I go back to what Paul said. He could be, the way he handles things, he could become one of the better ones in the last 50 years.
Absolutely. So many liberals have called for the expansion of the Supreme Court. Now, Mr. Karlowitz, how do you think Democratic lawmakers and President Biden could go about expanding the court?
Well, the number of seats on the Supreme Court is determined by Congress by law. The Constitution created the Supreme Court and gave the power to Congress by law to create the rest of the court structure by law, as well as the number of seats. The Supreme Court has been as small as 5 and as large as 10, and it's been 9 essentially since the Civil War. So there's a tradition there that's going to be hard to break, that the Supreme Court has been 9 seats for quite a long time. The Supreme Court does have the power, however, to alter the size of the court. And there's only been one serious attempt to do that, and that was in the late 1930s when Franklin Roosevelt was president. He proposed to add members to the Supreme Court. He proposed that to Congress because he was losing cases, and he ended up with a tremendous punch in the nose, one of the few real political defeats that FDR had during his tenure as president. When asked about this, both President-elect Biden and Vice President-elect Harris has evaded the question. I'm going to make the assumption that unless they start losing lots of cases on big issues, they're going to leave this issue alone because it's going to be a controversy they don't want to deal with. They're going to have enough problems, frankly, as it is. And already you've seen the Supreme Court rule against President Trump just the other day when it comes to accepting a case involving the Texas lawsuit trying to overturn the election in several states. And so even the Trump appointees ruled against Trump. Okay, so if the Supreme Court stays with a relatively moderate stance, regardless of who has appointed those justices, I think the Biden-Harris administration is going to stay away from that issue as much as possible.
Absolutely. So from an apolitical standpoint, do you think that the legitimacy of the Supreme Court would be compromised if the Democrats were able to expand it, or could it already be compromised by the imbalance favoring the Republican Party, a party that has only won the popular vote in one of the last 7 presidential elections? Dr. Hosmer, I'm going to ask you this first.
Well, it seems to me that I don't think John Roberts wants the Supreme Court to become politicized at all, and he'll work hard to, because it loses its influence and authority if people look at it as a Republican or a Democratic court. The anger that Democrats felt when Trump pushed through his third Supreme Court appointment with Coney Barrett, if the Democrats could have filled the court and done a court packing, they would have done it at that point. But then what happened is exactly what Paul mentioned. The court has moved away. They're going to be very careful in terms of losing their influence and their authority. Yeah, they may change the abortion issue, but that is so divisive, and they'll leave it up to the states. They'll say, okay, states get to decide what they want to do, and there will be a great deal of consternation about that. I'm going to be surprised if the court becomes highly political in the next few years, and we'll see. And I think it'll be interesting to watch Roberts as he sort of dances around trying to hold moderation in the court.
Mr. Karlowitz, do you have anything to add?
Well, I think what Dr. Hosmer essentially said is correct. And the concept of stare decisis, or precedent and tradition among the court, is a key. That even on the abortion issue, even those individuals who consider themselves strict constructionists would tend to be the conservative Republican appointees to the court. Many of them are going to be constrained by the precedent and the tradition of the court in terms of supporting a woman's right to choose. And so it'll be interesting to see if they really pull the trigger on any of these particular issues at this particular time, because obviously I don't think you would want to see that anybody on the Supreme Court would want to see the court become politicized and the threat of a court packing of sorts by the current president.
So President Trump, assuming that the Electoral College will choose President Biden to be the next president, what role will Trump play in the next 4 years? Will he sort of back out of the political world, or will he constantly be a thorn in the side of the Biden administration?
I think he'll still remain loud. And the question will be, is will anybody listen after a while? There has been some talk that he is going to set up Trump TV, to where he's going to set up his own television network as a stump for him to speak. If he does that, it almost resembles the classic movie Network. I don't know if any of you or your listeners are familiar with that movie, but where you have a television network essentially set up to spew craziness, that might be the case. He is so unpredictable, and that's been the difficulty I've had trying to teach government in the last 4 years, is that you don't know what he's going to do next. And that's part of the charm of Donald Trump for many people, but also some of the difficulty. But I think he's going to be loud at first. He's going to be very critical. The question is, will anybody listen? And I think over time his influence will diminish over the course of the next 4 years. So, and you got to figure that he would be close to 80 years old in 2024. Will age essentially keep him out of any kind of serious run at the presidency, although it didn't stop President-elect Biden at all.
Dr. Hosmer, would you like to add anything?
Well, it seems to me that I agree. I think there will be, I mean, if you think about it, 74 million people voted for Donald Trump, and you have a large number of Republicans right now that have their eye on that 74 million. Rubio and Graham, Rubio from Florida, who is right now in Georgia. He's campaigning in Georgia for the Republican Senate. I think they have their eye. And what they want to do essentially is become Trump light. The Republicans, I would be very surprised. And there was a wonderful article in the New York Times talking about what's the possibility of Trump running again. And it's essentially the argument was that Donald Trump has pretty much played his card, that he's one and done. And if you look back on George Wallace or Joseph McCarthy, they run for a while. They have a lot of energy, and then but the attitude that they have continues. And I won't be surprised if you don't find Republicans like Cotton out of Arkansas, who will pick up the mantle, looking at those 74 million votes, and they will be the standard bearer in 24, and not Donald Trump. The Democrats, I'm not as convinced as Mr. Karlowitz that Harris will be as viable a candidate. I'm betting that the people who become heroes from this pandemic are going to be the governors. The governors who say, look at what I did. Look at how I handled it. Look at how I became a leader, particularly these Democratic governors on the East and West Coast, that they're going to be the ones that throw their hat in the ring against and run for the presidency in 24. I'd be surprised if the Democrats picked Harris.
Now, the pardon power has been used quite liberally by President Trump. Can President Trump pardon himself while he is still in office, Mr. Karlowitz?
Well, that's a question that's up in the air right now. I've listened to a number of legal analysts saying that it would be unprecedented, but not necessarily illegal or unconstitutional. But the thing that one has to understand about the president's pardoning power is that he can only pardon individuals dealing with federal law, that they've violated federal law. Many of the allegations and the cases against President Trump that may be adjudicated after he leaves office are state-based. He cannot pardon himself of the state-based issue, especially the one that seems to be the most dangerous for him, is the one filed in the state of New York. And so, yeah, he can possibly get away with pardoning himself for any federal crimes that may have been committed at the time, but he cannot pardon himself for any of the state-based issues that may be coming to haunt him here in the near future.
Now, Dr. Hosmer kind of touched upon the future of the Republican Party. So, Mr. Karlowitz, if you were the head of the Republican Party, what would your next moves be? What do you think should be the future of the Republican Party?
Oh, my goodness. Well, obviously, the first move would be let's win the elections in Georgia. That would be the case. But even if the Republicans lose, they're not down and out. They still have the ability to use Senate rules to, again, block the most objectionable, from their point of view, Democratic legislation coming through. And so it would tell me that if they lose the elections in Georgia, that probably we need to de-Trumpify our party. If they win the elections in Georgia, then it appears that Donald Trump will be more of an influence. So if I could put that answer on hold until after the elections in Georgia, then I could probably give you a better, more credible response.
Sure. Now I'll end with a fun one. Should presidential candidates have to have a psychological evaluation? And if in the past they did have a psychological evaluation, which presidents do you think might not have been elected? Dr. Hosmer?
Oh, I have long thought that they should. Being president is the most difficult job in the world. You have too many problems. The eddies and shoals that the ship of state runs up against, it's enormous. And to say to someone, I really want to be president, I think that's the definition of insanity. And that, once a person throws his hat in the ring, they should be declared insane right there. And so should you have to take a psychological exam? I guess as soon as you want to, you know, release your taxes. Nathan, I have no idea. I would like for them to, but who would administer it? What kind of test would it be? Could you dispute it? There's so many problems with that. So
sure.
I think what you let the American people with their instincts and their guts decide.
All right. Mr. Karlowitz, any quick last words?
Okay, on the psychological exam, the question would be who would do it? And it recalls another bizarre movie from the 1960s called The President's Analyst. If you want to check that out with James Coburn, is that who would be doing that? And then what danger would that person be in if he would declare a candidate insane? So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. All right. So I want to thank both of my guests for joining us today. And of course, I want to thank all of the listeners who keep this show going. Shop local, stay safe, and thank you so much for joining us.